We are fortunate that the editor-in-chief of the Hampshire Chronicle and the editor of the Southern Daily Echo is our guest speaker, Mr. Ian Murray.
You notice how immediately a politician shies away. It's called Duncan. We've taken him from you. You're quite safe. No, we'll talk about it. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for, and thank you for those kind words, John. Thank you for, for inviting me here today. I hope you don't mind if I take my jacket off, actually. The honorary treasurer can do it, so can I. Leader of the Rats. I think that's usually a title given to the editor of a newspaper, isn't it? Certainly by certain politicians. And it's wonderful to be invited here. Now, John was telling me that I've got until about 6 o'clock this evening. Is that... No? Right. Okay. No. He says, keep it reasonably short. And I'm delighted if you want to ask me any questions. Either interrupt. I'm quite used to it. I have children. most of them work in the newsroom. And I will try in a very short period of time, 20, 25 minutes, to basically try and give you a little bit of detail of where we are now and where some of the articles come from that you so put so much effort into reading out for us and do such a worthy job. I'm in awe of the enunciation of the team, in particular at the moment as I'm having an awful lot of dental work done, so I'm lisping terribly, so please forgive me with those kind of things. I can't be bothered to fit the dentures in. I've been in journalism now for something like 35 years. I know, you're shocked. I started at the age of 3. Thank you. And I always knew that I wanted to be a journalist, or at least that's not quite true, because originally I wanted to go into advertising. And the reason for that was when I was quite young at school, my favourite television programme was a situation comedy called Bewitched. Mm-hmm. If you remember Bewitched. Yeah. And when I try and explain this to a slightly younger audience, if you'll forgive me for saying so, they think of the modern film with Will Farrell in it, and which is, you know, completely rubbish. Basically, this is the old TV series, wonderful, with Elizabeth Montgomery, who played Samantha, who was the housewife, who was actually a witch, modern witch, and she'd twitch her nose and magic would happen. She had a little daughter, Tabitha. Stick with me, sir. I think you can looking aghast here. She had a little daughter, Tabitha, who also had inherited her mother's powers, who could twitch her nose and magic would happen. And Samantha had a mother, Endora, the mother-in-law from Hades, who was a real witch and could all cause all kinds of problems, particularly for Samantha's husband, who, like the rest of us, was a mortal. I say that in the belief and hope that none of you are witches. I've got no idea. We are out in, you know, beautiful countryside here. He was a mortal, and all kinds of things would basically happen, all jolly japes, and they lived in a lovely big house in California, and he worked at the top of a skyscraper in Los Angeles, and he worked in advertising. And I thought, one day, when I grow up, that's what I want to do. I basically want to work in advertising, I want to have a big house in California, I want to drive a big car, have a swimming pool, and be married to a witch. Ladies and gentlemen, I didn't get that. I didn't get the job in California. I don't work in advertising, and my wife is a lovely lady. Her mother, on the other hand, no. Both ladies know I tell that, basically. But I did, I wanted to go into advertising. It was my head of English that said to me, Murray, why do you want to go into advertising? He said, well, I think you should consider journalism. Possibly. He said, because let's look at the facts. He says, you enjoy telling a good story, as you can tell. He said, you're fairly good at writing. You're very inquisitive, nosy. You're thick-skinned, and you can't spell. Perfect for the job. Perfect for the job. Yeah. And so that was it. And I thought, right, fine, I'll see if I can get into journalism. And I discovered there were basically one of two ways that you could get into journalism, and this was approaching the end of the 1970s, of course. So there were no degree courses in multimedia or even pure journalism any of the communications that exist today. There's wonderful ways, and of course also for advertising. So you went to university and you did an arts degree, history or maths or something like that. But basically you did that, and then you would hammer on the doors of the national newspapers. Or, if you wanted to get into the local newspapers, the best thing to do, I was informed, was basically go around knocking on doors and saying, I would quite like to start here. And if they like the cut of your jib, they basically take you on board, basically as a trainee in that way, give you a chance and see how that went. So I said to my parents that basically, having done my A-levels, that was what I was going to do. I was going to go in at the ground level, see if I could get that job. And after a year of hammering on doors, if I hadn't done it, I would take up the place I've been offered at university to study history, in fact. And I often wonder if I'd done that instead, because I love history. So that was it. And eventually, I did get an offer of an interview to go along to my very local newspaper in Stourbridge in the West Midlands. That's where the accent's coming from, if you're trying to place me from the Black Country. And I applied, and it was a local weekly newspaper, rather like the Hampshire Chronicle is today. It was I'll come to that in a second. And so I went along and saw the editor. You had to basically go through a number of stages of an application, and you spent time with the news editor, and the news editor would give you two tests to do, a general knowledge test, which my father had sat with me and tried to, you know, at the age of 19, possibly understand a little bit of the world, kind of thing. A spelling test. And then you would basically be ushered in to meet the editor himself for an interview and those sorts of things. And of course, the editors in those days were living gods, whereas, you know, I like to just... Let me just explain to you that a newsroom, as I often have to tell people, is not a democracy. A newsroom is not a democracy. Oh, yes, you listen and you take account from what other people say, but a newsroom is a dictatorship. Or in my case, as I tell everyone, a monarchy. So, I'm back on this first newspaper, so I did my general knowledge test, I did my spelling test, and then I was ushered in to see the editor in the Holy of Holies, which was his office, which I remember so well. And it was a very sunny day, and it was a very dark room. And to add to which, the editor, Mr. Hill, basically had got the blinds behind him closed so that just a little bit of light came in. He was sat at the desk, which had a very just one little light on it, one of those green glass lamped kind of lights. And to add to the atmosphere, he was smoking a pipe. So there was this layer of smoke that went across the room with a little bit of light coming in. And basically, I sat on one side of the desk and he sat on the other side of the desk. And halfway through our interview, his secretary came in with one cup of coffee and put it equidistant between the two of us on the table. Somehow I knew that wasn't for me, and I'm sure to this day, ladies and gentlemen, if I had picked up that cup of coffee and drunk it, I would not be in journalism today. And sure enough, when we chatted, and he chatted, asked all the usual questions that I discovered that was there, and then he asked me the question that I knew afterwards, because I was told, he asked every applicant for a job as a training reporter, which is, young man, what book are you reading at the moment? Now, I just happened to be reading a book by Ray Bradbury, who science fiction writer. I don't particularly read science fiction, I don't mind science fiction, but for some reason I must have just picked it up. And immediately, and for the first time, I finally got a look at him. He ducked underneath the smoke and enthusiastically said, what do you think? And something twigged that he was a science fiction buff. And it turned out he was. It turned out he wrote science fiction books. He didn't sell many in England, but he's very big in Denmark for some reason. So I basically chucked into the conversation every single reference I could think of to do with science fiction. I chucked in Isaac Asimov, Little Lost Robot, Mr. Spock, Dr. Spock. I couldn't remember which one had the pointed ears and which one was the child psychologist. Chucked them all in there, and he must have done the trick. Because a couple of days later, a letter arrived basically saying, dear Mr. Murray, thank you for attending the interview. Despite your appalling spelling, I've completely failed the test. We're going to take you on as a trainee reporter. And he'd misspelt appalling. Of course, I didn't know that. And my father had to point it out to me when he read the letter. And the reason I tell that story was actually the next bit, because after surviving my probation period, I was invited then to sign my indentures. Sign my indentures. My father was invited to come along and countersign them to say that during my training period, he would ensure that I would be of good character. What was that man doing? My father was, and he's at the age of 86, he's still with us, thankfully. Basically, he was an engineer. My brother is an engineer. And so he was never quite sure when I said I want to be a journalist, Dad, I want to be a writer. It was one of those kind of, you know, being brought up in the back streets of Birmingham and Smethwick with the hard knocks in the engineering world and this kind of thing. It was kind of, you know, they did their apprenticeships in foundries and they, what is this arty fairy world that you're going into kind of thing. And to this day, he still basically stares to me, when are you going to get a proper job? Absolutely. But he had to come along and do that. How the world has changed, and I've seen it change through all the years that I've been in journalism, that not so long ago, the idea that you would do apprenticeship, that's what it was. It was an apprenticeship that I was basically doing in something like journalism, had completely gone out of the window. Our whole industry was bringing in people from university. You have to have degrees to basically come in. And now more and more, we're going back to actually saying that we actually would like some people in our newsroom who actually have got a grounding in their local community. They may not have gone to university, some will have done, but we want you to come along, we want you to do an apprenticeship and we will train you. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it may come as a shock to you and Lord Justice Leveson, but journalists are trained. We do have to. I meant Lord Justice Leveson. You know who I'm talking about, Lord Justice Leveson, the Leveson Inquiry. About a week before he launched his inquiry in public, I had a phone call from the Newspaper Society, which is an organisation which looks after the interests of local newspapers, and they phoned up and said, Lord Justice Leveson has said that he'd like to go and visit a reasonably large regional newspaper. He's gone to see the offices of the Telegraph and the Daily Mail and the Times, etc. But he said, well, I ought to see the regional press as well. And we thought you were a pair of safe hands. Although they've obviously never met the staff at the Chronicle or the Echo to do that kind of thing. I said, yes, absolutely. When do you want him to come? And they said, tomorrow afternoon. I said, that doesn't give me enough time to get rid of this lot and hire in some actors and take down those posters, 10 easy steps to phone hacking. When the phone hacking inquiry, which can I just simply say, it is bad taste to actually joke about it because there were some terrible things that were basically done. I do not condone in any way. No one in the regional press does things like hack into phones. We just don't need to do that kind of thing and we don't condone it at all. If we were guilty of anything during all of that, it was that we didn't basically stand up for our industry. And I sit on various committees nationally where there are members, of course, of the national press. And they're very powerful and very imposing people. And you feel like, well, that's what they want to do. And a lot of the time they spend trying to get round the rules that exist in our profession, find ways to go round them, if not butter their way basically through them. And if we are guilty of anything in the regional press, it's that we let them get away with that without having the courage of standing up and saying, but that's not adhering to the principles that we really should be doing. So I think we've all taken that away and thought we should stand up a little bit more on principle for those kind of things. Not that I agree with everything that went on with the Lord Justice Leveson inquiry, but we'd be here till Christmas if we kept on talking about that. And I've only got another 2.5 hours to go. So, yes. So Lord Justice Leveson came along to actually see us. Phone hacking? No, we don't get involved with anything like that whatsoever. In fact, when that scandal broke, my managing director, and editors don't run newspapers, by the way. It's managing directors that run newspapers. I'll come back to that in a moment. My managing director at the time, the wonderful Stuart Dunn, who's actually chief executive of Hampshire Chamber of Commerce now, he stuck his head round my door and he said, Ian, I'm sure I don't have to ask. He said, but you're not involved in any way in phone hacking here, are you? To which I picked up my smartphone and said, Stuart, I'm not even sure how to switch this thing on. I'm trying to find if there's a 12-year-old work experience child around here that could basically program it for me. Seriously, we just had new landline phones fitted at the Daily Echo offices, and they just keep flashing at me. Just basically, if it wasn't for the wonderful Anne, who's my long-suffering PA who's been with me for over 20 years, both at Bournemouth, where I was before I came here, who I just basically say, it's flashing lights, Anne. Can you come in and find out how it works? And I'm sure when I leave the office, she goes over and get one of the work experience youngsters to come and deal with the phone. That's basically in there. The way that newsrooms are, I just basically said that it's not the editor that runs a newspaper, it's the managing director that runs the newspaper. I head up the editorial department. So like any business, any company, you have the person at the top, which is the MD, who looks after the whole thing, and then heads of different sections. The only difference with editorial, unlike the rest of the world, shall we say, that with regards to the Hampshire Chronicle, with regards to the Daily Echo and the other papers that I oversee, the Romsey Advertiser, the Andover Advertiser, the Basingstoke Gazette, the Chronicle, of course, the Reading Chronicle, the Bracknell News, the Slough Observer, etc. Somewhere over there towards Berkshire, I understand. I do go occasionally. As you cross the border. As with all of those, the managing director, I am the person who is legally responsible for the papers. So I am the person that actually has to say, no, you can't put that advert in the paper. I know you might want the money, but you can't put that in there because of whatever the legal reasons are that I basically feel. Because I'll go to jail. Please don't get any ideas. slip that advert here, the editor might go to jail. I'll go to jail if needs be, if I just completely disobey the rules that are basically there. And the other thing that is important that exists in good media organisations is editorial independence. And every organisation I've worked for, they have upheld that editorial independence. So the MD, the wonderful Amanda, I don't know if any of you know Amanda Davison-Young, who basically is my MD, she's very active in Rotary now here in Winchester, lives in Romsey, and she basically has never attempted. She might put her head around the door, as my previous MDs have said, you know, sort of like, that story you might be running on Fred's garage, selling dodgy cars. I'm sure that you've got it right, haven't you? To which I'll say, I'm absolutely certain we've got it. Yeah, just thought I'd mention it, which is code from her to be saying, I don't want to lose them as an advertiser. If you got this wrong, I'll sack you. You know. But she wouldn't dare threaten me in that kind of way. It's usually that kind of thing. She can't, for instance, come to me and say, Ian, I know there's a court case about Tesco selling dodgy bread, or that Indian restaurant has been caught with having problems or something like that, or whatever restaurant kind of thing. But we don't want to upset them because they've got money and they advertise, so you mustn't run those stories. She couldn't. She wouldn't dream of saying that. Seriously, she wouldn't. And no MD that I've got. That's the difference in the world of media and that sort of thing. Apart from that, really, newsrooms are the same today that they were when I first started out 35 years ago. 35 years ago, there is a big difference, actually, I have to say. 35 years ago, my first newspaper, the one where they rather foolishly gave me a job, I was reminded the other, not long ago, I was helping at a school to hand out the awards and prizes, and at the end of it, I get invited to do some wonderful, wonderful things like that. I was presenting the badge to the head boy, who'd just been appointed as head boy, and it reminded me, and I mentioned it then, and I'll mention to you now, that I had completely forgotten that, in fact, I probably got my first chance through fraud. Because it was not long after I'd actually started on my first job at that first, you know, where the head was basically, sorry, that the editor was so taken by the fact that I was interested in science fiction, that I was talking to the news editor and basically blah, 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 and saying, this is a fantastic chance, opportunity. And he said, well, yes, he said, we were very impressed by the details we've got. And when we did the references, of course, and we checked with your school, of course, they told us that you had been head boy. And I went, yes. Yes, oh, lovely school, love business school. It was a wonderful, you know, far from bog standard, comprehensive in the back end. Now, I knew that my brother had been head boy. They'd obviously got it completely mixed up when they'd gone for the reference. Do you remember Ian Murray? Is he the one that burnt the school down? No. Oh, he was head boy, wasn't he, kind of thing? No, it was Sam. It was my brother that actually was. So, did I fess up? No, I didn't. I wasn't that daft at that age to kind of do it. No, the big difference is that when I joined, there were only male reporters. There were no women reporters in the newsroom at all. They had basically had a female once just after the Second World War, and it hadn't worked out. The old boys told me, hadn't worked out. No. So they only took on one trainee at a time, got them a year through the process, and then they would take on another one, and it was always male. It was a far, far less, you know, it wasn't so distracting in the newsroom kind of thing. What was distracting was that the whole of the advertising department, of course, was female. Apart from the manager, of course, who had to be a male, you understand. Kind of had things going too far. So that was it. So, of course, the fraternising that used to go on, it was distracting, was whenever any of the ladies from the advertising department would pass, but I'm probably telling you too much. But basically went on with those kind of things. No, while I was there, they did actually, eventually, they took on their first female journalist since just after the Second World War. And the old boys were shocked. Absolutely shocked. Not only was she female, but she was taken on as a sub-editor. Now, a sub-editor takes the work, the copy that's been written by the reporters, and basically corrects it, knocks it into shape, and puts a headline on it. So a woman was correcting their work. What's more, she was Danish. A foreign woman was correcting. I tell you what, if we could have bothered to get out of the pub that Friday lunchtime, we could possibly have taken action, but as it was, we couldn't be bothered. Those kind of things. Those were the wonderful, wonderful days of weekly newspapers back then. Today, of course, it's completely different, completely different. Thankfully, we have a very diverse... And any editor worth his salt, and myself particularly, has to try and create a newsroom that reflects the communities into which we basically are serving and that we are basically covering and writing the news for, in that sense. If the whole newsroom was based on people exactly like myself, then obviously, I mean, I can see I'm beginning to irritate, if not turn all of you or put some of you to sleep at the back and that kind of thing. If it was completely based on the news editor, who is a former chain-smoking, now fitness fanatic Glaswegian chap, he's got one of those looks that the Queen and my mother has, you know, perfect, you know, can stop a charging horse at 50 paces kind of thing, you know. He only has to look across the room at one of the junior reporters and they sort of, like, shrink into their seats kind of thing. So we don't want them all based on him, for heaven's sakes. Everything in the newsroom has its place. So therefore, we have to try and get that in. And I base the newsroom on an episode of Winnie the Pooh. Or a book of Winnie the Pooh. Stick with me on this. I think I'm losing you again at the back over there. You see, because basically every newsroom you see, you need your Tiggers. Tiggers, if you remember, is the bouncy, bouncy, bouncy character, isn't he? You know, bouncy, bouncy, this kind of thing. And they're usually the young things that come in, and they're bouncy, 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 and you need to say, yes, we need you to go down and ask someone a stupid question. Yes, off they go. We need someone to sleep out all night with the Mayor of Winchester. Yes. Bouncy, 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 bouncy. Bouncy, oh, all those kind of things. And that's absolutely fantastic. But usually they have the attention span of, you know, of a five-year-old. So,
the Mayor of Winchester.
Oh, no, to make another. Yes, absolutely. None of this will be, you know, won't go any further. By the way, you're perfectly safe here. Nothing you say here will go any further than ourselves and 1.3 million visitors to the Daily Echo website. So you've got those kind of things. Then you need your Eeyores. Eeyore, the sad donkey kind of thing. This is my lot, kind of thing. Oh, misery me, misery me. But if Eeyore's anything, he's methodical. So you can give Eeyore a council agenda. And basically... you can't give it to Tigger, because Tigger will go, nothing, and off goes, you know, kind of thing. Whereas Eeyore will go, you say anything in it, Eeyore, and you'll go, oh, well, no, it's boring. But if you take that figure from that figure, then the deputy mayor's paid himself that much expense.
This week.
Yes, this week. And all at the Wetherspoons. You've got a Wetherspoons. So basically, yes, so you've got that kind of thing. So those two yin and yang officers. Then you've got your wise owls, you see. Wise owl is journalists that have been around a while or someone with a bit of a wise head on them who basically can say, you know, that's the third time that they've had a bit of a prang on that road. You know, don't you think we ought to ask a few more questions or, you know, kind of thing. What do you think they're spending £154 million that Eastleigh Borough Council have borrowed? That's one of our questions at the moment. With an income of, with a budget of 9 million, how have they ended up with a debt of 154? Those kind of questions that you sit up and go, oh, wise owl, that's not a bad question actually for us to sort of ask, you see. And then you might want to launch a campaign or a spotlight or a probe, or we use all these words basically, just another way of just being nosy. And so then you need your piglets, because piglets are your doers. Remember Piglet used to organise Winnie the Pooh's parties? So piglets, don't pretend you don't know. Piglet is the doer and everything and pulls it all together. Right, okay, so we need two reporters on that. We need a logo done on that, don't we? We need to make sure we've got some photographs of that. You know, so da-da-da-da-da, do we need to do any legal checks on this, et cetera, et cetera. And he's pulling the whole thing together and can run it. And then piglets usually gyrate towards the news desk because they're sort of running people or as chief reporters and those sort of things. Then you need Kanga. Remember Kanga and Roo? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see, you're admitting it now. So Kanga and Roo, you see, now Kanga is the mother and Roo's the little kangaroo which sits in her pouch kind of thing. And you need Kangas because then we need to mother and nurture the reporters, particularly the young ones, because they're coming these days increasingly so from a very mollycoddled, very protected, cosseted, not perhaps wrapped in duvets like your studio, but some ways. And we hear more and more about, you know, students going to university and they need to be in a complete safe zone and no one can basically challenge their views and their thoughts and all this kind of thing, etc. And now they're thrust into the real world and we say, you've got to go up to people and ask them questions that they may not want to be asked. They've got to go and ask people what it is that they basically, you know, think about something or other. And you've got to go up to some people who are upset. And one of the things, and I may as well tell you warts and all, because, I mean, you read the articles that are in the Hampshire Chronicle. You know, you go up and you ask people, it's called, unaffectionately, in the newspaper business, as a death knock, which is when someone has had a death or something like that to go and knock on the door and basically say, would you like to talk about your loss kind of thing. Now, any sane person at that point would shut the door in your face. But actually, I say sane, a lot of the time people do want to basically say, and if you can get past that how very dare you kind of moment, it can be quite cathartic. And when you try to explain to people that it's going to appear in the paper anyway, the inquest, the death, or whatever is going to appear in the paper anyway, and would you like to pay a tribute to the person? Would you like to try and explain a little bit about them, that they were more than a car crash victim or something like that? Then quite often that does give it. Because we equally get people angrily contacting us and basically saying, you put in about so-and-so's death, or I'm related to them in some way. You didn't have the courtesy to come to me to ask me to say something about them. So it sounds like an excuse, and I know it's gone very serious all of a problem of mine, but it is that balancing act that we actually have to go through in those kind of things. And we do think very hard about, particularly at a local level, about what we write. And for instance, today, sadly, we're running a story, I don't know if you've seen the Daily Echo, and no doubt being the Hampshire Chronicle as well, the story about the young lad, the 20-year-old rugby player who died in the car crash. On the way home from a match, and it was his inquest yesterday, kind of thing. Now, we had to judge basically how we were going to run that story, and usually we know an awful lot more than we're actually going to put in the public domain, because it can be seen as very distasteful and upsetting for things that are there. We also know that the inquest is going to reveal everything. So we can sit back in that case and basically decide that that's the point at which we're going to do it. Of the one subject that I, as a subject matter that I get the most complaints about, it's not criticising the doings of Winchester City Council, believe it or not. Did anyone mention Silver Hill?
I never mentioned it.
I never mentioned it at all.
Don't get me going.
Yes, and those kind of things. It's actually the coverage of inquests, which is perfectly understandable, because the inquest itself has reopened an old wound. They're just beginning to heal from the fact of losing a loved one, and now the inquest itself opens it up again, and now there it is in a newspaper. And we get asked, why? Why do you bother to? Why do you do that? Why do you rub salt into the wounds? And I say, and anyone who asks me that question, I will give a serious answer back to, which isn't usually what they want to hear, but my own personal opinion is that the investigation into the death of a citizen, an open investigation into the death of a citizen, is the most important aspect of our communities that we have. When that happens behind closed door, when governments and other organisations can push the death of a citizen investigation behind a door, that is the slippery slope. That's where totalitarianism starts. That's where, for the common good, we've looked into this, nothing to see here, folks, move on. So it is one of the most difficult things. So on all of that, that's when we get young journalists, more and more in particular, that come into the newsroom and they're not really equipped for this. They're not equipped for some of the hard knocks that are basically there. And so Kanga is needed to basically help them, advise them, and basically sit them down and calm them down when they've had one of those confrontations with another human being that basically they've recoiled from, quite understandable, which toughens them up a bit. It toughens them up when those kind of things. It toughens them up so they can ask politicians questions that politicians don't want to answer. But I'm sure that's not the case at Winchester at all. Silver Hill. Anyway, moving on from that. Locus. So, anyone else left in the newsroom? Well, yes, we also have Rabbit. Now, you remember Rabbit? Rabbit's the party pooper. Rabbit's the one going, oh, no, you can't do this, we shouldn't do that, we shouldn't do the other, etc., etc. And there's always one or two rabbits in the newsroom there going, you know, kind of like, no, we shouldn't do that, we shouldn't do that, you know, kind of care. You see, because occasionally Rabbit just might be right. You know, when Rabbit's there saying, no, you know, sort of like, is it legally safe to do that? Is it legally safe to that? Should you use the word fracking in the headline like that? I'll let that one sink in. Fracking, good idea. Seriously. Seriously, you have to stop the headlines. Just occasionally, Rabbit actually is talking sense. And just occasionally you go, oh, I'll call the lawyers. You know, so you need that. I won't say that Rabbit's your conscience, but possibly so. But party pooper, but basically you need someone in there who's basically dragging you back to reality from things. Because newsrooms are this strange fairyland kind of place that we don't live in the real world that's basically there. And we very quickly forget just how important someone's reputation is. Just how the fact that the majority of people do not appear in the media at all or very rarely. Obviously some politicians appear quite often. After today. Yes, what have you said about the mayor? 5 years old. The attention span of a 5 year old.
That would be me.
Yeah, completely safe. But the vast majority of people go about their lives and don't appear in the paper at all, do not get into the media at all. And then when they do, for good or bad, it's a very important moment in their lives. We become very cavalier about it. We become very casual. We see our names all the time in the media. You know, we're running stories on people all the time. And if there's one thing that really annoys me about folks in the newsroom is when I'll say to them, look, I've had so-and-so on the line. We went along and covered that story or whatever. When is it going to appear in the paper? Oh, well, when we've got space. Well, you know, they phoned once. I told them, yeah, we'll put it in when we feel like it. No. You won't, you put it in now and you'll tell them that it's going into the paper now, because it's important to them in that way that we do it. So it is important that we've got Rabbit in the room to actually do it. And of course, all these wonderful people, like herding turkeys in the right direction, you've got to have someone that they're going to look up to, someone that they respect. Christopher Robin. or in my case, Winnie the Pooh, basically, running around on the head of state. What does an editor do? Very briefly, because we're getting close to that three-hour cut-off that was there. What does an editor do? I'm often asked that question. What do you do? Usually by my MD. What do you do? My wife, my children, my parents. What is it that you do? Drink coffee and shout a lot. And I tell that I've heard many explanations of what an editor actually does. My two favourites, my first one, is an editor is someone who separates the wheat from the chaff and prints the chaff. But my really favourite, best one, is the one that says an editor is someone who manages creativity. And I think that sounds lovely, doesn't it? It sounds lovely. And it's true. I've got a room full of all those people that I've just described, whether they're basically in the middle of Winchester at the Hampshire Chronicle offices, or whether they're at Southampton, where we've got our main newsroom, or any of the other offices, all those wonderful, wonderful people in all those kinds of ways, all those kinds of things, and they're all wonderfully creative, and you've taught them all, we've trained them to basically not accept the first answer they're given, to ask why, how, what, well, why? Tell us why that's happened, not that it's happened, tell us why? And that's how we basically train them. Unless, of course, I'm telling them how much their pay rise is. And then I want them to say, thank you very much, and then just walk away. It never basically happens. So it's my job to basically say the whole idea of the paper, or papers, is that we're going to go in that direction with this paper. And with the Chronicle, probably we'll go in that direction. And the Andover Advertiser, in that direction. And the Slough Observer, somewhere over here. kind of think to judge where they're basically going to sit within the communities they're basically there. We're apolitical. We do not, Mr. Deputy Mayor, support or are against any one political party. We can take a biased opinion if we wish to in some way. We can be partial as well, as long as we make it plain that this is the reason we're doing this and this is the reason why we think we should be doing this. We should never mix it up, and we should never give the impression that we're being apolitical or basically impartial when we've actually taken a stance against something. But we should always give the opposite point of view that's basically there. Now, that's not with the national newspapers. The national newspapers do not have to do that. We have to do that. We have to do that because, A, we're in a geographical area, so we haven't got millions of people all over the country to go to who follow that political viewpoint or political stance that's there. But also because the difference between the national newspapers and myself is, for instance, Paul Dacre, who's the editor of the Daily Mail, who I have met and is a charming man. You wouldn't get on the wrong side of him, but he's a charming man. He seldom ever has to meet any of the people that he writes about or his papers write about. I do. When my newspaper's writing about local schools, local teachers, all kinds of things, local hospitals, local councils, I'm probably going to meet those people. And if we've upset them, they're going to let me know that we basically upset them. I know on certain terms. And they're going to let all of our readers know. And they're going to put that communication basically out there. So we can't do anything other than really seriously attempt to be fair and even-handed. And that's why the regional press is trusted more than any other press anywhere else in the country, any other media that's there. That's why I and other editors in the regional press shook our heads, and I am coming to an end. I can see you looking worried. I know I say get a stick with a hook on, you need to drag me off. That's why I and other editors in the regional press basically sort of winced when our companies basically launched themselves into the internet age and said, you know, don't worry about basically crafting the words, don't worry about making sure that the spelling's correct, don't worry about basically whether it's balanced or not. As soon as a story breaks, rush it up onto the internet. Those people that use the internet, they understand that it's just breaking news, it's snapshots, it's just a little taster, that kind of thing. They won't mind if it starts out being inaccurate and badly spelt and got terrible grammar and all kinds of things in it. Except, of course, you all do. You all do, and you come to us and you come to the BBC sites because you trust us. And that's why you come to us and not to some citizen blogger somewhere or something like that. You come to us. So it matters that we actually get it all right. And it matters that we continue to play an important role, whether it's on the internet, whether it's in the printed product, which are still going strong, I can tell you. And it matters that we continue to train, like I was trained from the early days, we continue to train our journalists. I have one story from, and then I'll close, which is from my early days. And as soon as I'd started on my first newspaper, the wonderful County Express in Stourbridge, they sent me off to a block release, good old block release, to do my training. And it was at Richmond College in Sheffield, which is a hallowed name in the training of journalists now. It's now no longer there, although there is a Sheffield, I think, university where they do it at now. And a certain gentleman in my class was a gentleman by the name of Jeremy Clarkson. Jeremy and I, he was an interesting character then. I can well remember he would always basically have a debate, if I can put it politely, with the lecturers in journalism, basically. And I can remember the one, and I wonder if he remembers it today, this lecturer, who basically said, "Jeremy, I can tell you now, but with that attitude, you're going to get nowhere in this profession." Wonder if he remembers it. But the story I'm going to tell very briefly was, I can remember there was a refectory to the college where we were, and outside the refectory, outside doors, windows like that, was the car park. And most of us were on weekly newspapers. I think we were all on weekly newspapers, and Jeremy was on something like the Rotherham Times or something like that. And about four of us were sat round a table. Jeremy was one of them, having a cup of coffee. And we noticed one of our classmates, young guy, drew up in a sparkling new car, basically parked it outside, gave us the thumbs up, and basically came in and joined us. And we went, "Whoa, very nice set of wheels," and that. So I presume daddy's money kind of thing. None of us could afford to buy something like that. He went, "No." He said, "I found this great trick." He said, basically, "I've become the paper's motoring correspondent." We said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "It's great." He said, "Every week you get a free car to drive around in, a free tank of petrol. It's brilliant for picking up the women." We said, "Brilliant." At which Jeremy leant forward and said, "Tell me more." And the rest, as they say, is hysterical. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to me. I don't know if anyone's got any questions at all.
Well,
for 2 minutes.
I was just going to say, does anyone have any questions for Ian?
No. Good.
I'll start you off. Was that book Fahrenheit 451?
Yes, it was. Yes. You're the other science fiction writer. You don't live in Denmark, do you, by any chance?
Strangely, no.
Yes.
I mean, I probably have half a dozen questions, but I think the obvious one is to ask you. We're all aware that local newspapers are being challenged at the moment, particularly by the internet. Do you have any feeling what the future for the Hampshire Chronicle might be?
Well, I get that asked that question all the time. The Hampshire Chronicle's future is absolutely secure. However, if you ask me the question, is the Hampshire Chronicle as a printed newspaper secure for all time? I would say I can't answer that question. I don't know. I would imagine so. The Hampshire Chronicle sales are doing very well, thank you. Weekly newspapers of a quality, which the Hampshire Chronicle, I assure you, are quite secure in that sense, because their readership tends to be extremely loyal, and it's we just have to be careful not to upset you by doing anything sudden, by suddenly swerving one way or the other. Someone once said to me quite recently, he said, "The Hampshire Chronicle," he says, it's not very," I said, "What are you trying to say?" it's not very, you know, salacious, is it? So I said, "Thank you very much." No, it's not. For that, may I point you towards the Daily Echo, if you wish for that reading choice. So the Hampshire Chronicle is, the internet is, only a couple of years ago, I would have said, look, you know, all of our titles are safe for as long as there is a generation that enjoys reading news prints. Mm. Because an older generation, and I know you're going to look at me, I'm not looking at anyone, but an older generation, which I count myself in, are basically not particularly interested in reading everything on computers, you know, because whatever, in that sort of thing. On which I base a lot of it on my dear father, 86 now, about 84 in those days, and that, because he retired more or less just as the computer age was coming in. he retired on that. Never worked on computers, really. Never had a computer, didn't want one at home when they first came in, your own PCs, that kind of thing. Even when laptops came in, they just didn't want to know. Mom and Dad just did not want to know. Even though I would point out to them, look, it's easy to use, it really is easy to use, and what you could use the laptop for, because as soon as they would come to stay with us or go to visit my sister, who lives in the Midlands as well, the first thing they'd say is, can you get your brother on the video link thing? Because my brother lives and works in Shanghai. So, of course, they didn't want to see him, actually. They wanted to see their granddaughter, of course. You know, I said that to him, Sam, they're not that interested in you, really. Just put your daughter in front of the screen. And that was it. And I said, well, can't you just, you know, look, we can show you how. No, it's the work of the devil. We can't have that in the room, that in the room, et cetera, et cetera. My dad, he just decided he didn't want to know, you know, in that kind of sense. And then I showed him my iPad. So I take it, I said, oh, look, this is all the thing now. And it was, yeah, I think it was about 2 years ago. This is the iPad. And I showed him it. Now, they hadn't got broadband at home, of course. They hadn't got anything like that. And my iPad at that point wasn't 3G. It was just you had to have broadband Wi-Fi to connect up to actually do it. So I could only show him some of the things. And I said, you could get one of these. And he went, what for? And I said, well, you can get on the World Wide Web, Dad, and all those kinds of things, etc. No. Right. So I teed up my brother. We went shopping. Do any of you know the Dudley area at all? There's a big shopping centre, the Merry Hill Shopping Centre, affectionately known as the Merry Hell Shopping Centre, particularly at Christmas, I can tell you. So I said, right, well, I'll take you on there whenever I'm up there. Yes, I know, you want to go to the Merry Hell, right, do the shopping. They like to go to Marks and Spencer's, you know, and then they buy things. And then next time I'm up, I take them back to Marks and Spencer so they can take them back. You know, it gets them out. So while we're there, I said, oh, I fancy a cup of coffee. Let's go into Starbucks. Well, they'd never been in Starbucks before. So in we went into Starbucks. And of course, they have free Wi-Fi in Starbucks. Da, 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 da. I said, oh, by the way. And opened it up. And there was my brother and his daughter, you know, kind of thing. And it's because my mother was giving that. What's this? Sort of thing. What are you doing? What is she wearing? What's the temperature? Shouldn't she be at school? It's middle of the night, Mom. Shouldn't she be in bed? So all that kind of thing. And Dad went, how did you do that? I said, well, it's very simple, Dad. You open it up like a book, and you go, and there it is, etc. He said, I could do that. I said, yes, you could. You could do that. It's that simple. I'll have one of those. Which, what he meant was, you'll buy me one of those. So we bought him one. And I said, and the good thing is, Dad, as well, you can also Kindle it, you can read your books on it. Oh, this is fantastic. And you can Google anything. What's Google anything? I said, well, you can go off and you can find... I'm not interested in that load of rubbish. Anyway, obviously, we can't stop him now. He's off, you know, launching attacks on the Pentagon, firing missiles. You know, he's always sending me dodgy pictures. Dodgy in the sense of strange, not dodgy, dodgy. One of the first things, there's a reason for this story. One of the first things he did was, I must take you back to Starbucks, of course, because, I mean, there were two things they got out of that day, which was, one, they learnt all about this iPod, which has changed their life, kind of thing. Although they haven't quite grasped, because I keep on telling them, just because they can't see me at the other end and it's spinning around saying reception lost, connection lost, doesn't mean I can't see them and hear everything that they're saying. I did eventually admit to that. All right, he's gone again. Well, he's gone for a beer. He's gone again. Gene, he's gone again.
That's basically.
And the other thing they learnt about was, how much for a cup of coffee? They never pay so much for a cup of coffee in their life. They still tell people today, have you been in one of those Starbucks things? Except, I don't know, they don't talk like that, but there we go. One of the first things he did was cancel his lifetime subscription to the Daily Mail. I said, what have you done that for? And he said, well, I can get it for free now. I can read it on the iPad. I said, yeah, Dad, but it's not the same. It's not the same as it is in print. The one on the iPad, the one that's on the web, is basically, you know, sort of salacious gossip and scantily clad reality TV starlets. He went, yeah, I know, don't tell your mother. But then I noticed when I've been round there of late, like a dutiful son, there in the magazine rack are copies of the Daily Mail. I said, I thought you'd... And he went, I said, I'm, you know, I said, I still look at the scantily clad starlets on the... But he said, I just missed having the paper. I missed that kind of thing. My mum said, yeah, he missed, actually. The paper boy delivers it every morning, and then Dad walks down to the paper shop in the afternoon to pay for the paper. Get him out, basically, that kind of thing. So that was a very long answer to your question of what's going to happen. I don't really know, but technology has changed so much. Does anyone here read newspapers on an iPad or one of those kind of things? Please, if you don't put your hands up, I'm going to be very disappointed.
I read the BBC. Does that count as a newspaper?
Yes, it does. You get your news from an iPad and that. Does everyone else read the Hampshire Chronicle? This is your moment to say.
Yes.
Not or a newspaper. Point. Or a newspaper you basically read. I'm going to do a very quick... I'm sorry, just tell me to get off when you want me to. I'm going to do a very quick thing around the room as to which newspapers you all read. I mean, we'll take it for granted you read the Hampshire Chronicle and the Daily Echo. So who reads The Guardian? One, two, three, right, four, five. Right, this is admission. This is The Telegraph. There we go. The Sun, not going to admit it.
Nobody's
The Mail, yeah, there we go, yes. Three ladies, not surprised. I'm trying to think if there's any other. The Times, yeah, that's sort of what I sort of expect. If I'm talking to a seminar of journalism students at places like Southampton University or Winchester University, when I ask the question, and I lead them into this deliberately, what newspapers do you read? Do you read newspapers? And of course they have to read newspapers because it's part of their curriculum, they read newspapers. So I know I'm on to a winner. Which newspapers do you read? If I say The Guardian, every hand goes up. Every single journalism student is far left wing and reads The Guardian kind of thing. I don't know where they get these journalists for that work on all the other newspapers, but they all, for some reason, are all there. Or I see something on the light on the road to Damascus or the reverse. I don't know which one it basically is as they're going along. So, and then I go through it and then I say, you know, and I get to sort of like The Sun and a few hands will go up and they go, only for the sport. It's the lads, you know, kind of thing, etc. And then the Daily Mail. And then there might be a couple of hands that creep up kind of thing, because that, to journalism students, is the Daily Mail is beyond the pale kind of thing. It's the unmentionable of newspapers. And that when I quiz them on it, they'll say usually, oh, because my parents have it, or because I like to do the crossword kind of thing, etc., etc. And I always say to them, why don't you read the Daily Mail? And they'll say, because it's homophobic and xenophobic and agoraphobic and all those kind of things. And I said, even if I agreed with you, which I'm not quite sure I do agree with you, I said, you are journalism students. Why aren't you reading the Daily Mail? It's like saying to a bunch of medical students, why don't you study cancer? And they say, because it's a horrible disease, I don't want to know about it. It's exactly the same reason, if you want to. I mean, the Daily Mail is the most wonderful newspaper in the sense that it is the most successful newspaper in the country. It creates the prejudices of Middle England and then panders to them. Absolutely phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. The way that it does it, I'm not saying I disagree with everything it says or I agree with everything it says. It is absolutely brilliant in the way that it does it. And you take the Mail on Sunday. And I use this as an example, and then I saw the Mail on Sunday, and I thought, that's it, it's a classic. It's the absolute classic. The Mail is wonderful in the sense it will say, isn't it dreadful? All these foreigners are stopping English grannies from getting into hospital. Isn't it absolutely dreadful? We should stop these sick people from abroad taking up our hospital beds. And then you turn the next pages, and it will say, thank you so much for your donations to help these bears in a terrible zoo in Krakow. So human beings in pain, they're foreign. Foreign bears, we must save them. It's kind of like, but you don't, everyone looks at you and goes, oh, cuddly bears, oh, horrible other people. You know, now I'm getting a little political here, I know. With
that. Just slightly.
Silver Hill. Let me chuck that one
property
in.
Section.
Has anyone got any the property section? Cheap. Nothing wrong with the property section. Nothing, no, never mind, let's move on from that. Any more questions at all? I realise I'm between you and the lovely cake. I think that's it. I think I've run over. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.